Recorded Books and RB Digital present The Best Science Fiction of the Year, Volume 2. Edited by Neil Clark. Narrated by Jay Ossing, Lauren Baldwin, Michael Braun, Ron Butler, Barbara Caruso, Mimi Chang, Ramon D'Ocampo, Fiona Hardingham, John Keating, Elizabeth Liang, Rich Miller, Sunila Nankani, Tom Rivera, and Jill Tanner. The Visitor from Torrid by Ian R. MacLeod. Narrated by Lauren Baldwin.
1. There was always something otherworldly about Rob Holm. Not that he wasn't charming and clever and good-looking, driven as well. Even during that first week when we'd arrived at university and waved goodbye to our parents and our childhoods, and were busy doing all the usual fresher things, which still involved getting dangerously drunk and pretending not to be homesick, and otherwise behaving like the prim, arrogant, cocky, and immature young assholes we undoubtedly were. Rob was chatting with research fellows, and quietly getting to know the best virtuals to hang out in. Even back then, us young undergrads were an endangered breed. Many universities had gone bankrupt, become commercial research utilities, or transform themselves into the academic theme parks of those so-called third-age academies. But still, here we all were at the traditional red-brick campus of Leeds University, which still offered a broad-ish range of courses to those with families rich enough to support them, or at least tolerant enough not to warn them against such folly. My own choice of degree, just to show how incredibly supportive my parents were, being analogue literature. As a subject, it already belonged with alchemy and Marxism in the dustbin of history. But books, and I really do mean those peculiar, old paper physical objects, had always been my thing. Even when I was far too young to understand what they were, and by rights should have been attracted by the bright, interactive, virtual gewgaws buzzing all around me, I'd managed to burrow into the bottom of an old box, down past the Sticklebricks and My Little Ponies, to these broad, cardboardy things that fell open and had these flat 2D shapes, and images that didn't move or respond in any normal way when I waved my podgy fingers in their direction. All you could do was simply look at them, that and chew their corners, and maybe scribble over their pages with some of the dried-up crayons which were also to be found amid those pre-digital layers. My parents had always been loving and tolerant of their daughter. They even encouraged little Lita's interest in these ancient artifacts. I remember my mother's finger moving slow and patient across the creased and yellowed pages as she traced the pictures, and her lips breathed the magical words that somehow arose from those flat lines. She wouldn't have assimilated data this way herself in years, if ever, so in a sense, we were both learning. The Hungry Caterpillar, the Mr. Men series, Where the Wild Things Are, Frodo's Adventures. Slowly, like some archaeologist discovering the world by deciphering the cartouches of the tombs in ancient Egypt, I learned how to perceive and interact through this antique medium. It was, well, the thingness of books. The exact way they didn't leap about or start giving off sounds, smells, and textures. That and how they didn't ask you which character you'd like to be, or what level you wanted to go to next, but simply took you by the hand and led you where they wanted you to go. Of course, I became a confirmed bibliophile, but I do still wonder how my life would have progressed if my parents had seen odd behaviour differently and taken me to some paediatric specialist. Almost certainly, I wouldn't be the Lita Ortiz who's writing these words for whoever might still be able to comprehend them, nor the one who was lucky enough to meet Rob Holm all those years ago in the teenage fug of those student halls back at Leeds University. 2. So, Rob. First thing to say is the obvious fact that most of us fancied him. It wasn't just the grey eyes or the courtly elegance or that soft Scottish accent, or even the way he somehow appeared mature and accomplished. It was, essentially, a kind of mystery. But he wasn't remotely standoffish. He went along with the fancy dress pub crawls, he drank, he fucked about, he took the odd tab. One of my earliest memories of Rob was finding him at some club, cool as you like amid all the noise, flash and flesh, and dragging him out onto the pulsing dance floor. One minute we were hovering above the skyscrapers of Beijing, and the next a shipwrecked storm was billowing about us. Rob, though, was simply there, taking it all in, laughing, responding, but somehow detached. Then, helping me down and out, past clanging temple bells and through prismatic sandstorms, to the entirely non-virtual hell of the toilets, his cool hands holding back my hair as I vomited. I never actually thanked Rob for this, I was too embarrassed, but the incident somehow made us more aware of each other. That, and maybe we shared a sense of otherness. He, after all, was studying astrophysics, and none of the rest of us even knew what that was, and had all that strange stuff going on across the walls of his room. Not flashing posters of the latest virtual boy band or porn empress, but slow-turning gas clouds, strange planets, distant stars and galaxies. That, and long runs of mech, whole arching rainbows of the stuff, endlessly twisting and turning. My room, on the other hand, was piled with the precious torn and foxed paperbacks I'd scoured from junk sites during my teenage years. Not, of course, that they were actually needed. Even if you were studying something as arcane as narrative fiction, you were still expected to download and virtualize all your resources. The analog literature faculty at Leeds University had once taken up a labyrinthine space in a red brick terrace at the east edge of the campus. But now, it had been invaded by dozens of more modern disciplines. Anything from speculative mech to non-concrete design to hollow pornography had taken bites out of it. I was already aware, how couldn't I be, that no significant novel or short story had been written in decades. But I was shocked to discover that only 5 other students in my year had elected for An Lit as their main subject. And one of those still resided in Seoul, and another was a post-centenarian on clicking steel legs. Most of the other students who showed up were dipping into the subject in the hope that it might add something useful to their main discipline. Invariably, they were disappointed. It wasn't just the difficulty of ploughing through page after page of non-interactive text. It was linear fiction's sheer lack of options, settings, choices. "Why the hell," I remember some kid shouting in a seminar, "should I accept all the miserable shit that this Hardy guy rains down his characters? Give me the base program for Tess of the D'Urbervilles, and I'll hack you 15 better endings." I pushed my weak mech to the limit during that first term, as I tried to formulate a tri-di excursus on Tender is the Night, but the whole piece was reconfigured out of existence once the faculty AIs got hold of it. Meanwhile, Rob Holm was clearly doing far better. I could hear him singing in the showers along from my room, and admired the way he didn't get involved in all the usual peeves and arguments. The physical sciences had a huge, brand-new facility at the west end of campus, called the Clearbright Building. Half church, half pagoda, and maybe half spaceship in the fizzing, shifting, headachy way of modern architecture. There was no real way of telling how much of it was actually made of brick, concrete, and glass, and how much consisted of virtual artifacts and energy fields. You could get seriously lost just staring at it. My first year went by, and I fought hard against crawling home and had a few unromantic flings, and made vegetable bolognese my signature dish, and somehow managed to get version 4.04 of my second-term excursus on Howard's End accepted. Rob and I didn't become close, but I liked his singing and the cinnamon scent he left hanging in the steam of the showers, and it was good to know that someone else was making a better hash of this whole undergraduate business than I was. "Hey, Lita." We were deep into the summer term, and exams were looming. Half the undergrads were back at home, and the other half were jacked up on learning streams or busy having breakdowns. I leaned in on Rob's doorway. "Yeah? I fancy sharing a house next year." "Next year?" Almost effortlessly casual, I pretended to consider this. "I really hadn't thought. It all depends." "Oh, not a problem," he shrugged. "I'm sure I'll find someone else." "Oh, no, that's fine. I mean, yeah, I'm in. I'm interested." "Oh, great. I'll show you what I've got from the Litton agencies." He smiled a warm smile, then returned to whatever wondrous creations were spinning above his desk. 3. We settled on a narrow house with bad drains, just off the Otley Road in Headingley, and I'm not sure whether I was relieved or disappointed when I discovered that his plan was that we share the place with some others. I roped in a couple of girls, Rob found a couple of guys, and we all got on pretty well. I had a proper boyfriend by then, a self-regarding jock called Torsten, and every now and then a different woman would emerge from Rob's room. Nothing serious ever seemed to come of this, but they were equally gorgeous, clever, and out of my league. A bunch of us used to head out to the moors for midnight bonfires during that second winter. I remember the smoke and the sparks spinning into the deep black as we sang and drank and asked around. Once, and with the help of a few tabs and cans, I asked Rob to name some constellations for me, and he put an arm around my waist and led me further into the dark. Over there, Lita, up to the left and far from the light of the city, is Ursa Major, the Great Bear, which is always a good place to start when you're stargazing. And there, see closest twins at the central bend of the plough's handle, are Miser and Alka. They're not a true binary, but if we had decent binoculars, we could see that Miser really does have a close companion. And there, that way, up and left, his breath on my face, his hands on my arms. Maybe you can just see there's this fuzzy speck at the bear's shoulder? Now, that's an entire, separate galaxy from our own, filled with billions of stars, and its light has taken about 12 million years to reach the two of us here tonight. Then Andromeda and Cassiopeia, and Canis, Major and Minor. Distant storybook names for distant worlds. I even wondered aloud about the possibility of other lives, existences, hardly expecting Rob to agree with me. But he did. And then he said something which struck me as strange. Not just out there either, Lita. There are other worlds all around us. It's just that we can't see them.
You're talking in some metaphorical sense, right?
Not at all. It's part of what I'm trying to understand in my studies. To be honest, I've got no real idea what astrophysics even means. Maybe you could tell me.
I'd love to.
And you know, Lita, I'm a complete dunce when it comes to, what do you call it? 2D fiction? Flat narrative? So I want you to tell me about that as well. Deal?
We wandered back toward the fire, and I didn't expect anything else to come of our promise, until Rob called to me when I was wandering past his room one wet, grey afternoon a week or so later. It was deadline day. My hair was a greasy mess. I was heading for the shower, and had an excursus on John Updike to finish.
You did say you wanted to know more about what I study.
I was just, I scratched my head, curious. All I do know is that astrophysics is about more than simply looking up at the night sky and giving names to things. That isn't even astronomy, is it?
You're not just being polite.
His soft granite grey eyes remained fixed on me.
No, I'm not. Absolutely.
But I could show you something here. He waved at the stars on his walls, the stuff spinning on his desk. But maybe we could go out?
To be honest, Lita, I could do with a break, and there's an experiment I could show you up at the Clearbright that might help explain what I mean about other worlds. But I understand if you're busy. I could get my avatar to talk to your avatar, and...
No, you're right, Rob. I could do with a break as well. Let's go out. Seize the day, or at least what's left of it. Just give me... I waved a finger toward the bathroom. 5 minutes?
Then we were outside in the sideways blowing drizzle, and it was freezing cold, and I was still wet from my hurried shower, as Rob slipped a companionable arm around mine as we climbed the hill toward the Otley Road tram stop. Kids and commuters got on and off as we jolted toward the strung lights of the city, their lips moving and their hands staring to things only they could feel and see. The Clearbright looked more than ever like some recently arrived spaceship as it glowed out through the gloom, but inside the place was just like any other campus building, with clamouring posters offering to restructure your loan, find you temporary work, or get you laid and hammered. Constant reminders, too, that Clearbright was the only smart juice to communicate in real time to your finger jewel, toe jam, or wrist bracelet. This souk-like aspect of modern unis not being something that Sebastian Flight or even Harry Potter in those disappointing sequels ever had to contend with. We got a fair few hellos, a couple of tenured types stopped to talk to Rob in a corridor, and I saw how people paused to listen to what he was saying. More than ever, I had him down as someone who was bound to succeed. Still,
I was expecting to be shown moon rocks, lightning bolts, or at least some clever virtual planetarium. But instead he took me into what looked like the kind of laboratory I'd been forced to waste many hours in at school, even if the equipment did seem a little fancier.
"This is the physics part of the Astro," Rob explained, perhaps sensing my disappointment.
"But you did ask about other worlds, right? And this is pretty much the only way I can show them to you." I won't go too far into the details, because I'd probably get them wrong. But what Rob proceeded to demonstrate was a version of what I now know to be the famous, or infamous, double-slit experiment. There was a long black tube on a workbench, and at one end of it was a laser, and at the other was a display screen attached to a device called a photomultiplier, a kind of sensor. In the middle, he placed a barrier with two narrow slits. It wasn't a great surprise even to me that the pulses of light caused a pretty dark light pattern of stripes to appear on the display at the far end. "These," Rob said, "were ripples of the interference pattern caused by the waves of light passing through the two slits, much as you'd get if you were pouring water. But light, Lita, is made up of individual packets of energy called photons. So what would happen if, instead of sending tens of thousands of them down the tube at once, we turned the laser down so far that it only emitted one photon at a time? Then, surely, each individual photon could only go through one or the other of the slits. There would be no ripples, and two simple stripes would emerge at the far end. But hey," as he slowed the beep of the signal counter until it was registering single digits, "the dark light bars, like a shimmering neon forest, remained. As if, although each photon was a single particle, it somehow became a blur of all its possibilities as it passed through both slits at once. Which, as far as anyone knew, was pretty much what happened."
"I'm sorry," Rob said afterwards, when we were chatting over a second or third pint of beer in the fog of an old student bar called the Eldon, which lay down the road from the university.
"I should have shown you something less boring."
"It wasn't boring. The implications are pretty strange, aren't they?"
"More than strange. It goes against almost everything else we know about physics and the world around us. Us sitting here in this pub, for instance. Things exist, right? They're either here or not. They don't flicker in and out of existence like ghosts. This whole particles blaring into wave business was one of the things that bugged me most when I was a kid finding out about science. It was even partly why I chose to study astrophysics. I thought there'd be answers. I'd understand when someone finally explained them to me. But there aren't." He sipped his beer. "All you get is something called the Copenhagen interpretation, which is basically a shoulder shrug that says, hey, these things happen at the subatomic level, but it doesn't really have to bother us or make sense in the world we know about and live in. That, and then there's something else called the many worlds theory." He trailed off, stifled a burp, seemed almost embarrassed.
"Which is what you believe in?"
"Believe isn't the right word. Things either are or they aren't in science. But yeah, I do. And the math supports it.
Simply put, Lita, it says that all the possible states and positions that every particle could exist in are real. That they're endlessly spinning off into other universes."
"You mean as if every choice you could make in a virtual was instantly mapped out in its entirety?"
"Exactly. But this is real. The world's all around us right here."
The drink and the conversation moved on, and now it was my turn to apologize to Rob, and his to say no, I wasn't boring him. Because books, novels, stories, they were my other worlds, the thing I believed in even if no one else cared about them. That single magical word, fog, which Dickens uses as he begins to conjure London, and Frederick Henry walking away from the hospital in the rain, and Rose of Sharon offering the starving man her breast after the Job's long journey across Dust Bowl America, and Candide eating fruit, and Bertie Wooster bumbling back across Mayfair. Rob listened, and seemed genuinely interested, even though he confessed he'd never read a single non-interactive story or novel. But, unlike most people, he said this as if he realized he was actually missing out on something. So we agreed I'd lend him some of my old paperbacks, and this, and what he'd shown me at the Clearbright, signaled a new phase in our relationship. 4. It seems to me now that some of the best hours of my life were spent not in reading books, but in sitting with Rob Holm in my cramped room in that house we shared back in Leeds and talking about them. What to read and admire, but also, and this was just as important, what not to. The Catcher in the Rye being overrated, and James Joyce a literary show-off, and Moby Dick wasn't really about much more than whales. Alarmingly, Rob was often ahead of me. He discovered a copy of Labyrinths by Jorge Luis Borges in a garage sale, which he gave to me as a gift and then kept borrowing back. But he was Rob Holm. He could solve the riddles of the cosmos and meanwhile explore literature as nothing but a hobby, and also help me out with my mech, so that I was finally able to produce the kind of arguments, links, and algorithms for my piece on Madame Bovary that the AIs at Anlit actually wanted. Meanwhile, I also found out about the kind of life Rob had come from. Both his parents were engineers, and he'd spent his early years in Aberdeen, but they'd moved to the Isle of Harris after his mother was diagnosed with a brain-damaging prion infection, probably caused by her liking for fresh salmon. Most of the fish were then factory-farmed in crowded pens in the Scottish lochs, where the creatures were doused with antibiotics and fed on pellets of processed meat, often recycled from the remains of their own breed, which, just as with cattle and Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease a century earlier, had resulted in a small but significant species leap. Rob's parents wanted to make the best of the years Alice Holm had left, and set up an ethical marine farm, although they preferred to call it a ranch, harvesting scallops on the Isle of Harris. Rob's father was still there at Cragach. And the business, which not only produced some of the best scallops in the Hebrides, but also benefited other marine life along the coastal shelf, was still going. Rob portrayed his childhood there as a happy time, with his mother still doing well despite the warnings of the scans, and regaling him with bedtime tales of Celtic myths, which was probably his only experience before meeting me of linear fictional narrative. There were the Kelpies, who lived in lochs and were like fine horses, and then there were the Blue Men of the Minch, who dwelt between Harris and the mainland, and sung up storms and summoned the waves with their voices. Then, one night, when Rob was 11, his mother waited until he and his father were asleep, then walked out across the shore and into the sea, and swam, and kept on swimming. No one could last long out there, the sea being so cold and the strong currents. Or perhaps the Blue Men of the Minch bore her body back to a stretch of shore around the headland from Cragach, where she was found next morning. Rob told his story without any obvious angst, but it certainly helped explain the sense of difference and distance he seemed to carry with him. That, and why he didn't fit. Not here, in Leeds, amid the fun, mess, and heartbreak of student life. Nor even, as I slowly came to realize, in the subject he was studying. He showed me the virtual planetarium at the Clearbright, and the signals from a probe passing through the Oort cloud, and even took me down to the tunnels of a mine, where a huge tank of cryogenically cooled fluid had been set up in the hope of detecting the dark matter, of which it had once believed most of our universe was made. It was an old thing now, creaking and leaking, and Rob was part of the small team of volunteers who kept it going. We stood close together in the dripping near dark, clicking hard hats and sharing each other's breath. And of course, I was thinking of other possibilities. Those fractional moments when things could go one of many ways. Our lips pressing, our bodies joining. But something, maybe a fear of losing him entirely, held me back. "It's another thing that science has given up on," he said later, when we were sitting at our table in the Elden. "Just like that ridiculous Copenhagen shoulder shrug. Without dark matter and dark energy, the way the galaxies rotate and recede from each other simply doesn't make mathematical sense. You know what the so-called smart money is on these days? Something called topographical deformity, which means that the basic laws of physics don't apply in the same way across the entire universe, that it's pockmarked with flaws." "But you don't believe that." "Of course I don't. It's fundamentally unscientific." "But you get glitches in even the most cleverly conceived virtuals, don't you? Even in novels, sometimes things don't always entirely add up." "Yeah, like Who Killed the Gardener in The Big Sleep? Or the season suddenly changing from autumn to spring in that Sherlock Holmes story. But this isn't like that, Lita. This isn't." For once, he was in danger of sounding bitter and contemptuous, but he held himself back. "And you're not going to give up?" He smiled, swelled his beer. "No, Lita, I'm definitely not." 5. Perhaps, inevitably, Rob's and my taste in books had started to drift apart. He'd discovered an antique genre called science fiction, something which the AIs at Anlit were particularly sniffy about. And even as he tried to lead me with him, I could see their point. Much of the prose was less than luminous, the characterization was sketchy, and, although a great deal of it was supposedly about the future, the predictions were laughably wrong. But Rob insisted that that wasn't the point, that SF was essentially a literature of ideas. That, and a sense of wonder. To him, wonder was particularly important. I could sometimes, maybe as that lonely astronaut passed through the Stargate, or with those huge worms in that book about a desert world, see his point. But most of it simply left me cold. Rob went off on secondment the following year to something called the Large Millimeter Array on the Atacama Plateau in Chile, and I, for want of anything better, kept the lease on our house in Headingley and got some new people in and did a master's on gender roles in George Eliot's Middlemarch. Of course, I paid him virtual visits, and we talked of the problems of altitude sickness and the changed arseholes our old uni friends were becoming as he put me on a camera on a jeep and bounced me across the dark-skied desert. Another year went. They were already picking up speed, and Rob found the time for a drink before he headed off to some untenured post, part research, part teaching, in Heidelberg, that he didn't seem particularly satisfied with. He was still reading. Apparently there hadn't been much else to do in Chile. But I realized our days of talking about Proust or Henry James had gone. He'd settled into, you might almost say, retreated, a subgenre of SF known as alternate history, where all the stuff he'd been telling me about our world continually branching off into all its possibilities was dramatized on a big scale. Hitler had won World War II, a great many times, it seemed, and the South was triumphant in the American Civil War. That, and the Spanish Armada had succeeded, and Europe remained under the thrall of medieval Roman Catholicism, and Lee Harvey Oswald's bullet had grazed past President Kennedy's head. I didn't take this odd obsession as a particularly good sign as we exchanged chaste hugs and kisses in the street outside the Eldon and went our separate ways. I had a job of sorts, thanks to Sun Mi, my fellow Anlit student from Korea, teaching English to the kids of rich families in Seoul. And for a while it was fun, and the people were incredibly friendly. But then I grew bored and managed to wrangle an interview with one of the media conglomerates which had switched physical base to Korea in the wake of the California earthquake. I was hired for considerably less than I was getting paid teaching English, and took the crowded commute every morning to a vast, half-real, semi-ziggurat high-rise mistily floating above the Maypo district, where I studied high-res worlds filled with headache-inducing marvels, and was invited to come up with ideas in equally headache-inducing meetings. I, an Alice in these many virtual wonderlands, brought a kind of puzzled innocence to my role. 2, maybe 3 decades earlier, the other developers might still have known enough to recognize my plagiarisms, if only from old movies their parents had once talked about. But now, what I was saying seemed new, fresh, and quirky. I was a thieving literary magpie, and became the go-to girl for unexpected turns and twists. The real murderer of Roger Ackroyd, and the dog collar in The Great Gatsby, not to mention what Little Father Time does in Jude the Obscure, and the horror of Sophie's Choice. I pillaged them all, and many others. Even the strange idea that the Victorians had developed steam-powered computers, thanks to my continued conversations with Rob. Wherever we actually were, we got into the habit of meeting up at a virtual recreation of the Bar of Eldon, which, either as some show-off feat of virtual engineering, or a post-postmodern art project, some student had created. The pub had been mapped in real time down to the atom and the pixel, and the ghosts of our avatars often got strange looks from real undergrads bunking off from afternoon seminars. We could actually order a drink, and even taste the beer, although, of course, we couldn't ingest it. Probably no bad thing in view of the state of the Eldon's toilets. But somehow, That 5 pints and still clear-headed feeling only added to the slightly illicit pleasure of our meetings. At least, at first. It was becoming apparent that, as he switched from city to city, campus to campus, project to project, Rob was in danger of turning into one of those aging, permanent students, clinging to short-term contracts, temporary relationships and get-me-by loans, and the worst thing was that, with typical and flinching clarity, he knew it. "I reckon I was either born too early or too late, Lita," he said as he sipped his virtual beer. "That was even what one of the assessors actually said to me a year or so ago when I tried to persuade her to back my project." "So you scientists have to pitch ideas as well?" He laughed, but that warm, Hebridean sound was turning bitter. "How else does the world work? But maths doesn't change even if fashions do. The many-world theory is the only way that the behaviour of the subatomic particles can be reconciled with everything else we know. Just because something's hard to prove doesn't mean it should be ignored." By this time, I was busier than ever. Instead of providing ideas other people could profit from, I'd set up my own consultancy, which had thrived, and made me a great deal of money. By now, in fact, I had more of the stuff than most people would have known what to do with. But I did. I'd reserved a new apartment in a swish, high-res, high-rise development going up overlooking the Han River, and was struggling to get the builders to understand that I wanted the main interior space to be turned into something called a library. I showed them old walkthroughs of the Bodleian in Oxford, and the Reading Room of the British Museum, and the Brotherton in Leeds, and many other lost places of learning. Of course, I already had a substantial collection of books in a secure, fireproofed, climate-controlled warehouse, but now I began to acquire more. The once great public collections were either in storage or scattered to the winds. But there were still enough people as rich and crazy as I was to ensure that the really rare stuff, first folios, early editions, hand-typed versions of great works, remained expensive and sought after. And I surprised even myself with the determination and ruthlessness of my pursuits. After all, what else was I going to spend my time and money on? There was no grand opening of my library. In fact, I was anxious to get all the builders and conservators, both human and otherwise, out of the way, so I could have the place entirely to myself. Then, I just stood there, breathing in the air, with its savour of lost forests and dreams. There were first editions of great novels by Nabokov, Dos Passos, Stendhal, Calvino and Wells, and an early translation of Cervantes, and a fine collection of Swift's works. Even, in a small nod to Rob, a long shelf of pulp magazines, with titles like Amazing Stories and Weird Tales, although their lurid covers of busty maidens being engulfed by intergalactic centipedes were generally faded and torn. Not that I cared about the pristine state of my whispering pages. Author's signatures, yes. The thrill of knowing Hemingway's hands had once briefly grasped this edition, but the rest didn't matter. At least, apart from the thrill of beating others in my quest. Books, after all, were old by definition. Squashed moths, old bus tickets, coffee cup circles, exclamations in the margin. I treasured the evidence of their long lives. After an hour or two of shameless gloating and browsing, I decided to call Rob. My avatar had been busy as me with the finishing touches to my library, and now it struggled to find him. What it did eventually unearth was a short report stating that Callum Home, a fish farmer on the Isle of Harris, had been drowned in a boating accident a week earlier. Of course, Rob would be there now. Should I contact him? Should I leave him to mourn undisturbed? What kind of friend was I anyway not to have even picked up on this news until now? I turned around the vast, domed space I'd created in confusion and distress. Hey, I span back. The Rob Home who stood before me looked tired, but composed. He'd grown a beard, and there were a few flecks of silver now in it and his hair. I could taste the sea air around him, hear the cry of gulls. Rob! I'd have hugged him if the energy field permissions I'd set up in this library had allowed. I'm so sorry. I should have found out. I should have... You shouldn't have done anything, Lita. Why do you think I kept this quiet? I wanted to be alone up here in Harris to sort things out, but... He looked up, around.
What a fabulous place you've created.
As I showed him around my shelves and acquisitions, and his ghost fingers briefly passed through the pages of my first edition Gatsby, and the adverts for X-ray specs in an edition of Science Wonder Stories, he told me how his father had gone out in his launch to deal with some broken tethers on one of the kelp beds and been caught by a sudden squall. His body, of course, had been washed up, borne by to the same stretch of shore where Rob's mother had been found.
It wasn't intentional, Rob said. I'm absolutely sure of that. Dad was still in his prime and proud of what he was doing. There was no way he was ever going to give up. He just misjudged a coming storm. I'm the same, of course, you know that, Lita, better than anyone.
So, what happens next? With business, there must be a lot to tie up.
I'm not tying up anything.
You're going to stay there? I tried to keep the incredulity out of my voice.
Why not? To be honest, my so-called scientific career has been running on empty for years. What I'd like to prove is never going to get back in. I'm not like you, I mean.
He gestured at the tiered shelves.
You can make anything you want become real.
6. Rob wasn't the sort to put on an act. If he said he was happy ditching research and filling his father's role as a marine farmer on some remote island, that was because he was. I never quite did find the time to physically visit him in Harris. It was, after all, on the other side of the globe. And he, with the daily commitments of the family business, didn't get to Seoul. But I came to appreciate my glimpses of the island's strange beauty. That and the regular arrival of chilled, vacuum-packed boxes of fresh scallops. But was this really enough for Rob Holm? Somehow, despite his evident pride at what he was doing and the funny stories he told of the island's other inhabitants, and even the occasional mention of some woman he'd met at Clegg, I didn't think it was. After all, Cragach was his mother's and father's vision, not his. Although he remained coy about the details, I knew he still longed to bring his many-worlds experiment to life. That, and that it would be complicated, controversial, and costly to do so. I'd have been more than happy to offer financial help, but I knew he'd refuse. So what else could I do? My media company had grown. I had mentors, advisors, and consultants, both human and AI. And Rob would have been genuinely useful. But he had too many issues with the lack of rigor and logic in this world to put up with all glitches, fudges, and contradictions of virtual ones. Then, I had a better idea.
You know why nothing ever changes here, don't you? He asked me as our avatars sat together at the Elden late one afternoon. Not the smell from the toilets or the unfestive Christmas decorations, or that dusty Pernod optic behind the bar. This isn't a feed from the real pub any longer. The old Elden was demolished years ago. All we've been sitting in ever since is just a clever formation of what the place would be like if it still existed. Bar staff, students, us and all.
Although nothing changed, the whole place seemed to shimmer. How things are these days. The real and the unreal get so blurry you can't tell which is which. But, you know, I added, as if the thought had just occurred to me, there's a project that's been going the rounds of the studios here in Seoul. It's a series about the wonders of science, one of those proper, real-time, factual things. But we keep stumbling over finding the right presenter. Someone fresh, but with the background and personality to carry the whole thing along.
You don't mean me.
But why not? It'd only be part-time. Might even help you promote what you're doing at Cragach.
A scientific popularizer.
Yes, like Carl Sagan, for example. Or maybe Stephen Jay Gould. I had him. And the series, which of course had been years in development purgatory, came about. I thought of it as little more than a way of getting Rob some decent money. But, from the first live-streamed episode, it was a success. After all, he was still charming and persuasive, and his salt-and-pepper beard gave him gravitas, and made him, if anything, even better looking. He used the giant's causeway to demonstrate the physics of fractures. He made this weird kind of pendulum to show why we could never predict the weather for more than a few days ahead. He swam with the whales off Tierra del Fuego. The only thing he didn't seem to want to explain was the odd way that photons behaved when you shot them down a double-slotted tube. That, and the inconsistencies between how galaxies revolved and Newton's and Einstein's laws. In the matter of a very few years, Rob Holm was rich, and of course, and although he never actively courted it, he grew famous. He stood on podiums and looked fetchingly puzzled. He shook a dubious hand with gurning politicians. He even turned down offers to appear at music festivals and had to take regular legal steps to prevent the pirating of his virtual identity. He even finally visited me in Seoul and experienced the wonders of my library at first hand. At last, Rob had out-achieved me. Then, just when I and most of the rest of the world had him pigeonholed as that handsome, softly accented guy who did those popular science things, his avatar returned the contract for his upcoming series unsigned. I might have forgotten that getting rich was supposed to be the means to an end, but he, of course, hadn't. "So," I said, as we sat together for what turned out to be the last time in our shared illusion of the Elden, "you succeed with this project, you get a positive result and prove the many worlds theory is true. What happens after that?" "I publish, of course. The data'll be public, peer-reviewed, and since when has being right ever been enough?" "That's," he brushed a speck of virtual beer foam from his grey beard, "how science works. And no one ever had to sell themselves to gain attention? Even Galileo had to do that stunt with the cannonballs. As I explained in my last series, that story of the Tower of Pisa was an invention of his early biographers. Oh, come on, Rob. You know what I mean." He looked uncomfortable, but of course, he already had the fame. All he had to do was stop all this Greta Garbo shit and milk it. So, effectively, I became PR agent for Rob's long-planned experiment. There was, after all, a lot for the educated layman, let alone the general public, or us so-called media professionals, to absorb. What was needed was a handle, a simple selling point, and after a little research, I found one. A man in a business suit had arrived at Tokyo Airport in the summer of 1954. He was Caucasian, but spoke reasonable Japanese, and everything about him seemed normal, apart from his passport. It looked genuine, but was from somewhere called Torred, which the officials couldn't find in any of their directories. The visitor was as baffled as they were. When a map was produced, he pointed to Andorra, a tiny but ancient republic between France and Spain, which he insisted was Torred. The humane and sensible course was to find him somewhere to sleep while further inquiries were made. Guards were posted outside the door of a secure hotel room high in a tower block. But the mysterious man had vanished without a trace in the morning, and the visitor from Torred was never seen again. Rob was dubious, then grew uncharacteristically cross when he learned that the publicity meme had already been released. To him, and despite the fact that I thought he'd been reading this kind of thing for years, the story was just another urban legend, and would further alienate the scientific establishment when he desperately needed their help. In effect, what he had to obtain was time and bandwidth from every available gravitational observatory, both here on Earth and up in orbit, during a crucial observational window, and time was already short. It was as the final hours ticked down in a fervid air of stop-go technical problems, last-minute doubts, and sudden demands for money, that I finally took the suborbital from Seoul to Frankfurt, then the SkyTrain on to Glasgow, and some thrumming, windy thing of string and carbon fibre along the Scottish west coast, and across the shining Minch. The craft landed in Stornoway Harbour in the Isle of Lewis, the northern part of the long landmass of which Harris forms the south, where I was rowed ashore, and eventually found a bubble bus to take me across purple moorland and past scattered white bungalows, then up amid ancient peaks. Rob stood waiting on the far side of the road at the final stop, and we were both shivering as we hugged in the cold spring sunlight. But I was here, and so was he, and he'd done a great job at keeping back the rest of the world, and even I wouldn't have had it any other way. It seemed as if most of the niggles and issues had finally been sorted. Even if a few of his planned sources had pulled out, he'd still have all the data he needed. Come tomorrow, Rob Holm would either be a prophet or a pariah. 7. He still slept in the same narrow bed he'd had as a child, in the rusty-roofed cottage down by the shore at Cragach, while his parents' bedroom was now filled with expensive processing and monitoring equipment, along with a high-band, multiple-redundancy satellite feed. Downstairs, there was a parlour where Rob kept his small book collection in an alcove by the fire. I was surprised to see that it was almost entirely poetry. A scatter of Larkin, Eliot, Frost, Dickinson, Pope, Yeats, and Donne, and standard collections amid a few Asimovs, Clarks, and Le Guins, with a low tartan divan where he sat to read these works, which, I supposed, might also serve as a second bed, although he hadn't yet made it up. He took me out on his launch, showed me his scallop beds and the glorious views of this ragged land, with its impossibly wide and empty beaches. And there, just around the headland, was the stretch of bay where both Rob's parents had been found, and I almost hear the blue men of the Minch calling to us over the sigh of the sea. There were standing stones on the horizon, and an old whaling station at the head of a lock, and a hill topped by a medieval church, filled with the bodies of the chieftains who had given these lands such a savage reputation through their bloody feuds. And meanwhile, the vast cosmic shudder of the collision of two black holes was travelling toward us at light speed. There were scallops, of course, for dinner, mixed in with some fried dab and chopped mushroom, bacon, and a few leaves of wild garlic, all washed down with malt whiskey, and with whey-buttered soda bread on the side, which was the Highland way. Then, up in humming shrine of his parents' old bedroom, Rob checked on the status of his precious sources again. The black hole binaries had been spiralling towards each other for tens of thousands of years, and observed here on Earth for decades. In many ways, and despite their supposed mystery, black holes were apparently simple objects, nothing but sheer mass, and even though their collision was so far off it had actually happened when we humans were still learning how to use tools, it was possible to predict within hours, if not minutes, when the effects of this event would finally reach Earth. There were gravitational observatories, vast array laser interferometers, in deep space and underground in terrestrial sites, all waiting to record this moment, and Rob was tapping into them. All everyone else expected to see, in fact, all the various institutes and faculties had tuned their devices to look for, was this. Leaning over me, Rob called up a display to show a sharp spike, a huge peak in the data, as the black holes swallowed each other, and the shock of their collision flooded out in the asymmetrical pulse of a gravitational wave.
"But this isn't what I want, Lita. Incredibly faint though that signal is, a mere ripple deep in the fabric of the cosmos. I'm looking to combine and filter all those results, and find something even fainter." "This," he dragged up on another screen, "is what I expected to see."
There was the same central peak, but this time it was surrounded by a fan of smaller, ever-decreasing ripples, eerily reminiscent of the display Rob had once shown me of the ghost flicker of those photons all those years ago in Leeds.
"These are echoes of the black hole collision in other universes."
I reached out to touch the floating screen, felt the incredible presence of the dark matter of other worlds. "And all of this will happen tonight." He smiled. 8. There was nothing else left to be done. The observatories Rob was tapping into were all remote, independent, autonomous devices. So we took out chairs into the dark and drank some more whiskey and collected driftwood and lit a fire on the shore. We talked about books, nothing new but some shared favourites, Poe and Pasternak and Fitzgerald. And Rob confessed that he hadn't got on anything like as well as he'd pretended with his first forays into literature. How he'd found the antique language and odd punctuation got in the way. It was even a while before he understood the obvious need for a physical bookmark. He'd have given up with the whole concept if it hadn't been for my shining, evident faith.
"You know, it was Gulliver's Travels that finally really turned it around for me. Swift was so clever and rude and funny and angry, yet he could also tell a great story. That bit about those Laputan astronomers, studying the stars from down in their cave, and trying to harvest sunbeams from marrows. Well, that's us right here, isn't it?"
The fire settled, We poured ourselves some more whiskey, and Rob recited a poem by Li Po about drinking with the moon's shadow. And then we remembered those days back in Leeds, when we'd gone out onto the moors, and drank and ingested far more than was good for us, and danced like savages, and, yes, there had even been that time that he and I had gazed up at the stars. We stood up now, and Rob led me away from the settling fire. The stars were so bright here, and the night sky was so black that it felt like falling merely to look up. Over there in the west, Leta, is the Taurus constellation. It's where the Crab Nebula lies, the remains of a supernova the Chinese recorded back in 1054, and it's in part of the Milky Way known as the Perseus Arm, which is where our dark binaries will soon end their fatal dance. I was leaning into him as he held his arms around me, and perhaps both of us were breathing a little faster than was entirely due to the wonders of the cosmos. What time is it now, Rob? It's, he checked his watch, just after midnight. So, there's still time? Time for what? We kissed, then crossed the shore and climbed the stairs to Rob's single bed. It was sweet and somewhat drunken, and quickly over. The earth, the universe, didn't exactly move, but it felt far more like making love than merely having sex, and I curled up against Rob afterwards and breathed his cinnamon scent and fell into a well of star-seeing contentment. Rob? The sky beyond the window was already showing the first traces of dawn as I got up, telling myself that he'd be next door in his parents' old room, or walking the shore as he and his avatar strove to deal with a torrent of interview requests. But I sensed that something was wrong. It wasn't hard for me to pull up the right screen amid the humming machines in his parents' room, proficient at mech as I now was. The event, the collision, had definitely occurred. The spike of its gravitational wave had been recorded by every observatory. But the next screen, the one where Rob had combined, filtered, and refined all the data, displayed no ripples, echoes from other worlds. I ran outside shouting Rob's name. I checked the house feeds. I paced back and forth. I got my avatar to contact the authorities. I did all the things you do when someone you love suddenly goes missing. But a large part of me already knew it was far too late. Helicopter arrived, drones circled, locals gathered. Fishermen arrived in trawlers and skiffs. Then came the bother of news feeds, all the publicity I could ever have wished for, but not like this. I ended up sitting on the rocks of that bay around the headland from Cragach as the day progressed, waiting for the currents to bear Rob's body to this place where he could join his parents. I'm still waiting. 9. Few people actually remember Rob Holm these days. And if they do, it's as that good-looking guy who used to present those slightly weird nature, or was it science, feeds, and didn't he die in some odd, sad kind of way? But I still remember him. And I still miss him. And I still often wonder what really happened on that night when he left the bed we briefly shared. The explanation given by the authorities, that he'd seen his theory dashed and then walked out into the freezing waters of the Minch, still isn't something I can bring myself to accept. So maybe he really was like the visitor from Tored, and simply vanished from a universe which couldn't support what he believed. I read few novels or short stories now. The plots, the pages, seem over-involved. Murals rather than elegant miniatures. Rough-hewn rocks instead of jewels. But the funny thing is that, as my interest in them has dwindled, books have become popular again. There are new publishers, even new writers, and you'll find pop-up bookstores in every city. Thousands now flock to my library in Seoul every year, and I upset the conservators by allowing them to take my precious volumes down from their shelves. After all, isn't that exactly what books are for? But I rarely go there myself. In fact, I hardly ever leave the Isle of Harris, or even Cragach, which Rob, with typical consideration and foresight, left me in his will. I do my best with the scallop farm, pottering about in the launch and trying to keep the crabs and the starfish at bay, although the business barely turns a profit, and probably never did. What I do keep returning to is Rob's small collection of poetry. I have lingered with Eliot's Proofrock amid the chains of the sea, wondered with Hardy what might have happened if he and that woman had sheltered from the rain a minute more, and watched as Sylvia Plath's children burst those final balloons. I just wish that Rob was here to share these precious words and moments with me, but all there is you and I, dear, faithful reader, and the blue men of the Minch calling to the waves.